you can click on the entry for October 3rd, Lesson 152, Majesty, the King Behind the King James Bible. And then if you click on this link down here, under that you can load the notes that we're going to be using here in class to teach this lesson. So we want to welcome you to the broadcast. So look at the introduction. Let's get rolling with this. As always, we've got a lot of ground to cover. Last week in Lesson 151, we reviewed the pre-Jamesian political and religious context that existed during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. As the successor of Elizabeth, James inherited these conditions when he became King of England in 1604. So I think we need to change that to 1603. He had the Hampton Court Conference, which we'll talk about next, or in a few weeks, in 1604. Today in Lesson 152, we want to look at the life of King James prior to ascending the throne of England. We're going to be talking about his life before he became King of England. Queen Elizabeth died on the morning of March 24th, 1603. Later the same day, James VI of Scotland was declared King James I of England. Sir Robert Cecil, Elizabeth's chief minister, had been negotiating this move behind closed doors since 1601. Okay? So, 1603, Elizabeth is going to die in 1603, and what was the date on that again? March, so 3/24/03, Elizabeth is going to die, and that same day, James is going to become King of England, okay? So, understand that when James becomes King of England, he was already King James I of Scotland, I'm sorry, the 6th of Scotland. And then he's going to become King James I of what?
England.
So he is now going to be king over both England and Scotland and everything else, Ireland and some other places that the queen had been the queen over. All right. So James is going to become king over both countries at the death of Queen Elizabeth. Okay. So let's look at the next point. A short history of King James. So I have a little asterisk here because there's a note that I want to share with you about this before we get into the nuts and the bolts of this. So please note that I am relying on David Team's 2011 book, Majesty, the King Behind the King James Bible, for much of the information presented in this section. Team's book was written as part of the commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. The purpose of this section is not to be an exhaustive biography of the life of King James, as that is outside of the scope of this class. Our purpose is to focus on those aspects of James's life that impacted his decision to authorize a new translation of the Bible in 1604. So there's a lot of stuff that we could say about James. This is the book I'm using. I forgot it at home, of course. I wanted to bring it in, but I forgot it at home. Majesty, the King Behind the King James Bible. This was published in 2011. In a whole host of books that were put out in 2011 to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. So I just want to say something about this book before we move on. This book is written for a popular audience. This book is not the most academic or scholarly biography that you could buy on James. There are definitely others out there that are older, that are probably going to be more detailed and give you more information. But I elected for the purposes of this lesson to use this one because we have a bit more of a popular audience here, and we don't necessarily have to get into all of the nuts and the bolts of everything that a more academic or scholarly treatment of James's life would have gotten into. So we're going to primarily be using this book right here to talk about James's life, all right? So look at the first point then. James Charles Stuart was born on June 19, 1566, to Mary, Queen of Scots, between 9 and 10 in the morning. James was great-grandson of Henry VII, King of England and Lord of Ireland, and thus a potential successor to all three thrones. So that would be Scotland, England, and Ireland. So Mary, Queen of Scots, that's not Bloody Mary, this is a different person, is James's mom. And he is born in 1566, and he is, because of who his grandfather is, this is the line of succession, as far as his great-great-grandfather, etc., James is potentially the ruler, could potentially inherit the throne of Scotland, England, and Ireland, which he ultimately is going to do, okay, before he's done with his, before he dies, I should say, okay? So according to Teams, how are we going to say this, Dave? Tem or Teams?
Teams.
According to Teams, James was baptized as a child in the Catholic manner on Tuesday, December 17, 1556. Okay, now we have an incongruency on these dates here, because this would have him being baptized before he's born, according to the previous point. So obviously that's not possible. So Sylvia, we need to make a note for me to check these dates, because something is not right. You think it's 66?
Yeah.
All right, I kind of think that's right as well. So there's a typo in the second point. So let me start over. According to Teams, James was baptized as a child in the Catholic manner on Tuesday, December 17, 1566, we're going to say. This is what he says, quote, the child was baptized Charles James, Prince and Steward of Scotland, Duke of Rothesay, Earl of Kyle, Carchick and Cunningham, Lord of the Isles, and Baron of Renfrew. So that's what he's baptized as. All of that. That whole thing is his title, when he's born and baptized, okay? It was a festive event filled with all the usual pomp and ritual. At the insistence of the Queen, the baptism was Catholic. His godparents were the King of France and the Queen of England, Elizabeth, and the Duke of Savoy. Of course, they were not there. The Scottish lords, as a sign of soft protest, stood outside of the chamber. So, James is baptized as a baby, as an infant, in the Catholic manner. So this is a problem for the lords in Scotland, because they are almost all Presbyterians. They are not Catholics, and they do not approve of James being baptized in the Catholic manner. So they are present, but they are standing outside of the room, outside of the chamber where the baptism ceremony is taking place, as a form of soft protest that they don't like the fact that James is being baptized in the Catholic manner. Okay, is everybody following that point? So, the situation with James's parents reads like a tabloid journal or soap opera. There are far too many twists and turns, while interesting, are not necessary for our purposes in this class. Suffice it to say that James never had a relationship, James never had a relationship with either of his biological parents, and was essentially raised by nannies and tutors. Okay? So James, listen, if you want the details on this, grab the book, read two chapters of the book, and it'll give you the gist of the situation with James's parents. But it is a star-crossed relationship. There's murder involved. There's all sorts of, you know, stuff going on in the relationship with James's parents. What you need to know, what we need to know, is that James never has a relationship with his mom. He never has a relationship with his dad. And he is basically, in his early years, as a young child, a ward of the state, and he is basically raised by nannies and tutors, not his parents. Okay? Now, even by the standards of those days, this is pretty extreme situation that the young James is in, because he has no counsel, no, you know, guidance, no nothing from his parents, basically. Okay? So look at the quote there. Mary more or less abandoned James. One writer summarizes it this way. In the strange and unnatural relation of Mary and her son, it was Mary who committed the first great wrong. So James is basically abandoned. His dad is totally uninterested. He's basically a drunken tad who, you know, nobody likes. His mom basically abandons him shortly after he's born. And James is going to be raised as a ward of the state by basically nannies and tutors. James was crowned James the VI of Scotland at the ripe old age of 13 months. So he's 13 months old when he's crowned King of Scotland. Neither of his parents attended his coronation. In contrast to his baptism, James's coronation was Protestant, overseen by a few members of the Scottish Kirk, a largely Presbyterian body. So this word Kirk is going to come up a lot in this lesson. The Kirk is the name given to the Scottish Church. All right? The Scottish Kirk, the Scottish Church, is largely Presbyterian. So James's baptism as an infant was done in the Catholic manner. The lords and everybody stood outside the chamber as a form of soft protest. But when he is coronated the king at the age of 13 months, his coronation is going to be overseen by the Scottish Kirk, the Scottish Church, and it's going to be conducted in a Protestant ceremony. Okay? Look at the quote. The little coronation took place at the Church of the Holy Rood, that's how I would say that, the parish kirk at Stirling, on a craggy hillside that rose to the castle. A total of 7 attended. John Knox preached the coronation sermon and used the moment to throw more slime on the absent Mary, the beloved Jezebel. The Earl of Morton took the coronation oath on behalf of James. He was, quote, to rule in the faith, fear, and love of God and maintain the religion then professed in Scotland. The Bishop Orkney crowned the king. So, none of his parents are there. John Knox, who was also an exile, he was also one of these Protestants who went to Calvin's Geneva during the reign of Bloody Mary, and he comes back and is very influential in establishing the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. He is going to preach this, and he's basically going to use the opportunity to just rip on James's mom. Okay? So, James obviously is 13 months old. He's got no say in any of this. This is just all sort of happening as part of the pomp and circumstance of the state, and James really has nothing to say, and there's only 7 people at this thing. So, you can kind of get a little bit of a sense of the situation there, both within James's family, but then also sort of the political situation in Scotland. Bart, you look like you wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, what precipitated him being crowned the
Scotland?
Well,
he's in the line of succession, and his mom, Mary, Queen of Scots, basically is forced to abdicate for a variety of reasons that I'm not going to get into because they're too technical. We don't really need those points for what we're trying to accomplish. So he becomes king at the age of 13 months. Well, obviously, is he too young to rule? So that means there's going to be a system of regents and so on that are going to rule in his stead because he's not of age yet. Look at the next point. While the king's coronation was celebrated by fireworks, shooting of cannon, and feasting, James was too young to rule, which meant Scotland would be ruled by appointed regents. According to Teams, having a baby on the throne was somewhat common practice in Scotland. He says, quote, baby kings and baby queens had been the rule in Scotland since 1406. James V, the grandfather of our king, was crowned king at 17 months old. His daughter Mary was Queen of Scots at 6 days old. That meant the country was managed by regents appointed to rule in the name of the king or queen. These serial minorities were beneficial to the nobles, who gained in both power and autonomy, wearing the name of the king like a badge. It became the odd and yet unquestioned architecture of Scottish politics. Okay? So, if you're a noble, do you love this?
Yeah.
You absolutely love this. Why? Because you have minor kings. So, they're not able to really do anything or challenge your authority or any of that sort of thing, right? So, if you're a Scottish noble, do you love this situation where you have this succession of monarchs coming to the throne that are, minors? And so you have all these regions. So, of course, the Scottish nobility is going to take advantage of all of this or try to use it to their advantage to increase their own power and, do all sorts of crazy stuff. And they're not going to like the fact that eventually James is going to grow up. And for good, bad, right, wrong, or indifferent, James is going to become ultimately a fairly powerful king. And they're not going to like it so much when he comes to power and starts to assert his authority. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, okay? So, on pages 33 to 35, Teams chronicles the list of 4 regents who ruled Scotland in James's stead while he was a minor. Quote, like his mother, James provided bad luck to these men. The Earl of Moray, Mary's half-brother, was the first to rule. Of course, rule is a bit misleading. Not having the name, pedigree, or divine right of kings, I should say, I think. Divine right of, let's check that, Sylvia, mark that and check that. The regent, while not altogether powerless, was still subject to the kirk, which is the church again. Remember, that we see the word kirk, think church, which was subject to the kirk and the nobles, who were always scheming, always circumnavigating, always playing a bit of a shell game. If you need an image to capture the regent, you might think of substitute teachers you had in high school. Everybody knows, right? When they come into class and there's the sub, what do they think? I can get away with something this hour, right? Well, that's basically the imagery of what's going on here, right? So you have these regents, they have no pedigree, they're not really anything except basically managers, and everybody takes the opportunity under these regents to basically be unruly children, okay? Next paragraph. Maury was assassinated, shot in 1570 when James was 4 years old. The next to quote rule was James's paternal grandfather, the Earl of Lennox. The somewhat nervous Lennox was the choice of Elizabeth as well. Elizabeth had strings and pulleys everywhere in the Scottish government. Lennox was shot in 1571, and young James, 5 at this time, had the added honor of watching him die. Honor. But anyway, he's 5-year-old. There's his grandfather. He's there and watches him be assassinated, okay, at the age of 5. James actually loved the old man and was fond of him. As one source said, love was something that James had little experience with. The third regent was his caretaker, the Earl of Mar. His regency lasted a whole year. It is assumed, and it would be nice to assume, that Mar died of natural causes in 1572 when James was 6. The fourth and last regent was James Douglas, the Earl of Morton. His tenure actually began in 1573 when James was 7. Morton was tougher and more savvy than the other regents. Morton had both slither and brains. He also had Elizabeth's backing, and he lasted longer than the other regents, but eventually lost his head, literally. The Kirk and the nobles were always scheming and counter-scheming, watching, circumnavigating, always playing the game of dominance and advantage, and that is how headship was conducted in Scotland. It was the established order James was going to have to survive and somehow beat. So here's what you need to understand. James is a minor. You've got these 4 regents that are ruling Scotland. 2 of them are assassinated, 1 in front of them. The other one we don't know. The third one we don't know exactly how he died. This fourth one is the best one of the 4 and is regent for the longest amount of time. Now, have any of you, I know, I'm sort of a dork, but any Lord of the Rings fans, I interpret these regents as like the stewards, like the steward of Gondor, you know what I'm saying? Like, he's not really the king, but he's entrusted with, seeing that things are going reasonably well. That's basically what these regents were, okay? Now, so the situation is a political mess. So James is going to somehow, number one, have to survive this without himself being assassinated, right? And then as he's coming up, he's going to have to deal with these power-hungry nobles that are always, moving and trying to get, advantage over one another, as well as a pretty strong Scottish Kirk or church that isn't going to want to just give too much power over to the king either. So this is the situation that James is, being reared in politically. As a young boy, there was a real sense in which James was the property of Scotland. Quote, when James was 3, the Parliament at Stirling commanded that there be no contact between the king and his mother except through the council. Now that the young king was Scotland's alone, the going strategy was misdirection. Keep him too busy to feel. Fill his day with industry and study, with the emblems of pious and worthy kingcraft, and shift his heart from its queen, his mother, for even there she must be dethroned. The Kirk and the nobles had just the man for the job. So understand, do any of the lords or anybody in the church, do they want James to have a relationship with his mom? No. So the mom did the first wrong by abandoning him, but now the powers that be are going to take the young king and they're going to intentionally seek to isolate him from his mother. Okay? Is everybody following this? Any questions so far? Right?
At least it might have saved his life. Sounds like everybody else was assassinated.
I mean, it could have. Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, that could be the case. It might have saved his life, this isolation.
I mean, but that one was killed in front of him. What prevented him from being taken as well?
I don't know the details of why James was not also assassinated, but obviously he survived and was not. But he does watch his grandfather be, you know, murdered right in front of him. James's education was overseen by the brilliant but tyrannical George Buchanan. Teams covers this point in chapter 5 titled, Greek Before Breakfast, Latin Before Scots. Quote, to waste no time, and not to let the royal mind go to spoil, the boy king was put to rigorous study under the harsh but brilliant tutelage of George Buchanan. Buchanan lobbied for the position before there was such a position. Philosopher, poet, Latinist, Buchanan was perhaps the best educator to be found, not only in Scotland, but he had an impressive reputation in the world at large. He had once been the teacher of the great Michel de Montaigne, the French essayist. 60 years older than James, Buchanan was an old man in the winter of life, set in his ways and intolerant of large names and sapling princes. He was a brutal master with a biting wit. Other than his great intellect, he had the one particular quality the authorities admired most. He hated the king's mother. Backed by the church, he was more or less father. He was more or less father. So in other words, of all the people in James's early life, for good or for bad, this guy is probably going to shape him the most. Okay? Buchanan considered it part of the king's education to malign the Queen of Scots. He never missed an opportunity to wreck what small memory the boy had. Buchanan was brilliant, original, unflinching, and unafraid, especially before a nervous, excitable, overstrong boy like James. It is amusing, and it reveals something about the boy, but as much as Buchanan tried to make James into his perfect king, James was inclined toward the exact opposite. Newton's law of reciprocal action applies. To every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Buchanan considered democratic nationalism the ideal form of government, which he said, quote, proved most conducive of human good. James thought no such thing. Buchanan created an adult-sized syllabus for his young charge, and a great part of the education of the king was a knowledge of scriptures, being intimate with the Bible. A chapter of the Bible was read and discussed at every meal. In 1588, a Jesuit, James Gordon, said, quote, James is naturally eloquent, had a keen intelligence, and very powerful memory. For he knows a great part of the Bible by heart, he cites not only chapters, but even verses in a perfectly marvelous way. So, what you need to get from that is James having extremely high-level, intense academic training here by a very authoritarian tutor who is basically trying to mold James into his image. All right, is everybody following this? Okay. So his education is broad, it's wide-scoping, it includes philosophy, politics, it includes Latin, it includes the Bible, it included Scripture. James, according to all reports that I've ever seen, James was very influenced, very fluent, I should say, in the Bible. He could quote a bunch of it. He knew the Bible very well. He knew what the Bible said on a great many subjects. Okay? Now, I'm not suggesting that he knew anything about dispensational truth or anything like that, but is the Bible a part of his education at the hands of Buchanan here? Okay? So, in summation, while noting his tyrannical nature and propensity to strike James, so this guy would beat him. Buchanan would hit James and beat him if he stepped out of line. Okay? Teams called Buchanan, quote, an effective educator of sovereigns and an architect of great minds. So, when I picture in my mind this description of James's education, I think like old school, like nuns in a Catholic school, you know, where you step out of line and you get the ruler or something, right on your knuckles or something like that, right? That's what I envision when I read about James's education. So, it's broad, it's intense, but there's some fear involved in this thing too for the young boy as he's being, you know, basically reared in a way by this very authoritarian tutor, Buchanan. All right. Now, before we go any further, anybody have any questions? Yeah.
How old was James at this time? Because the tutor was 50 years older than him, but didn't say when he started.
So I would assume, I don't know the exact age of when this guy started tutoring him, but it had to be sometime between basically 5 and 12 or 13. So it was for a long time that this guy was, you know, tutoring James. A very, probably maybe 10 years even. Like, this is not just a short period of time. That's why I say this guy, more than anybody else, influenced who he ended up to be. Right? Teams notes that James, quote, developed and exercised his academic prowess as a means of compensating for his physical imperfections. So apparently James was not a very attractive person. And, you know, you can think what you want. That's another reason why I left this image up here. This is a famous painting of James. He's obviously much older, but in his youth, he was, you know, kind of like not very athletic and gangly and, you know, not real attractive, apparently. You know, he wasn't a good-looking child or anything like that. So what he does then is he throws himself into academics and being the smartest guy in the room kind of a concept, right? I know I'm not going to be the best looking, the most athletic, and so on and so forth, so I'm going to go this route where I know I can kind of develop myself. So look at the quote here on page 4. Being born a king doesn't always guarantee one will have the capacity or the necessary aptitude to be a king. James had capacity. His physical weakness was an advantage because it belied an intellect that was not weak or stricken in the limbs. This will sound like a contradiction, but beneath his renowned cowardice, and I don't really know why he chose that word, but that's what it says, his renowned cowardice was a somewhat courageous mind. James V had the goods to be a fine king. James VI had the proper instincts to rule, and those instincts were set at liberty not only by the severity of his education, but also by the deadly challenges, the Goliaths that stepped in his path. He survived, and that is an accomplishment. Though he abandoned much of what he learned when he put on the English crown, in Scotland he learned when to keep his mouth shut and when to speak. So, the picture you should have of James is of a sort of physically non-imposing person in his physical stature, in his appearance, but somebody who kind of knew that and then sort of went into the direction of academics and knowledge and thinking and reason and logic, etc., as a way to compensate for what he perceived to be his physical limitations and weaknesses. Okay? So, is everybody with me? On March 8, 1578, at the age of 11, James's minority status was set aside, and he became the official ruler of Scotland, though many would still try and control him and exert their own influence. So James is going to be sort of officially deemed worthy to rule at the age of 11 on March 8, 1578. Okay? At the age of 11. So, you know, like, I have two boys, and I can't see them ruling anything at age 11, but, you know, anyway, or 16 for that matter. But here's what he says, quote, Scotland suffered chronic identity crises, a condition that made the nobles rich, made the church both powerful and pontifical, and made the throne, just as they wanted it, impotent, a poor country with a poor self-image run by a pack of animals. So that's what James is stepping into now. Okay? Look at top page 5. Now, it would take James until 1583. So let's look at these dates here. Look at the bottom of page 4. He officially becomes king in 1578 at the age of 11. And everyone's still kind of trying to tell him what to do, right? So look at the top of page 5. It would take James until 1583 to wrest supreme control over the government from his ravenous pack of rivals. So James is not really, he's technically the king, but he's not really exercising the power, the total power and authority of a king until about 1583. Okay? So let's look at what this says. Quote, it was called the Sovereignty Act of 1584, a timely little piece of legislation handed down by a king growing more and more into his power. The Sovereignty Act was an act confirming the king's majesty royal power over all state and subjects within this realm. Okay, so let's stop right there. Is this definitely a power move by James? What's this power move designed to do? It's designed to signal to everybody in Scotland that I am the king. All you rivals and you guys in the Scottish Kirk and all you nobles out there, you need to step up and take note that I'm the supreme ruler in Scotland. This is a specific, calculated, strategic move on James's part here in 1584. So, the Sovereignty Act is passed in 1584. He starts to go that direction in 1583. So look at the next paragraph. Parliament...
How was that passed? Because would they realize what that meant? Or did they think they still had them under control?
I think... So it's a great question. I think it's basically... It says here, Pete, a tiny little piece of legislation, but notice what it says, handed down. This is like basically the king decreeing this to be the case.
Okay.
And then of course everyone's gonna whine and cry and have a fit and, you know, say, oh, you can't do that and all this sort of stuff, like you expect. But the decree is basically being handed down by James. It's basically a royal pronunciation. Look at the next point. Parliament declared James head of the Church of Scotland. He and his Privy Council were given jurisdiction over ecclesiastical cases. The courts and assemblies of the Kirk were dissolved and could not reconvene without royal sanction. So James is now stepping into his authority. And he's now going to say, all you freaks out here that want to just question me, you're done. You don't want to do what I say? You know, I have my ways of dealing with you, right? So, he was 11 by this point. He's a late teenager, and he is definitely stepping into his power at this point. The Kirk, now here you see the church rebelling. Next paragraph. The Kirk referred to these acts as the, quote, Black Acts. Many ministers took flight to England, and quickly. This flight concerned James. He was still young enough to feel the sting of their backbiting and the gnashing of their teeth. They had been nipping at his heels all his life. And a novice king makes an easy target for slander. So, he says, listen, I'm dissolving the church no longer, the Kirk no longer has this jurisdiction. I'm the king of Scotland. I'm head of this church in Scotland. Okay? All the ecclesiastical courts are now subject to me. And of course, this is going to send a bunch of these churchmen, you know, fleeing Scotland because they think he's out to get them. All right. At a minimum, is he at least stripping them of their authority that they previously had, you know, before he sort of comes of age here, if you will. So it was during these days that James's political and religious views began to solidify. Quote: according to the young king's vision, government and church were harmoniously joined and in himself. So James viewed himself as the head of the state and the head of the church. Okay? Now remember what we saw earlier. His tutor, Buchanan, was he trying to steer him a different direction than this? He was trying to steer more towards a more democratic sort of form and away from this type of, you know, absolutism here. But James, when he gets his shot, he is definitely going to step in to the concept of divine right of kings and absolute monarchy like we're going to see here. Okay? So according to the young king's vision, government and church were harmoniously joined in himself. This was the monarch's birthright. The share of divinity he was given at birth was for this reason to unite the warring tribes, spiritual and temporal, into one person. It was a theme he would not depart from. All the schism within his own psychology worked within him, and by such a powerful algorithm that union became the driving force of his theory of government. Okay? So James is very much going to say, and we'll see in a minute, very strong statements, right? He is very much going to say, I have a portion of divinity by divine right. I am supposed to be the head of the state and the head of the church. Look at the next paragraph. The issue was that of bishops or no bishops. Now, so here's the thing. Could James have easily sort of waved his scepter and done away with all that if he wanted to? It was either episcopacy or Presbyterianism. After all the smoke cleared, a compromise was reached. The bishops remained. James had his way, not fully, but sufficiently, and he was 18 at the time. Okay? So at this point, do we see a king emerging and stepping into his power and asserting his power and asserting his authority now in a way that is obviously going to make the nobility and these churchmen upset? Because up to this point, for almost 200 years, have they been able to basically do what they want under this series of minority rulers, etc., and all these regents and all this stuff? And so James is, you know, going to definitely challenge all of that here as he's now stepping into his power at the age of 18. Now, anybody got any questions before we go to the next point?
Where does that concept of nobility come from God? You know, were they, you know, not just England, but, you know, all the places in Europe, you know, they all thought that, you know, this is my God-given right, you know, or all. Where does that...
So I would say possibly two or three things, okay? First of all, through what I would consider to be a misapplication of certain verses of Scripture. Second would be from the Catholic hierarchy, because, I mean, the Pope basically views himself as the spokesman of God, right? And then there develops within the nobility of Europe this idea that God is the one who made them king. And so they represent God in the earth, at least politically. So for a while there was this concept, especially in the Middle Ages, this concept, and I taught about this in the Grace History Project. It's called the theory of like the two swords, that there's a religious sword and there's a political sword. Throughout most of the Middle Ages in Europe, the Pope wielded the spiritual sword and the kings wielded the political sword, right? Even, and I would say to you that the Pope was still kind of like this over these kings, because he could excommunicate them. He could put them, have you ever heard of something called interdiction? He could put a whole country, if he was upset with a king, he could put the whole realm under what they called interdiction. And what interdiction was is that whole nation or kingdom was barred from taking the sacraments. So this is really a political manipulation maneuver, right? Because under Catholicism at the time, if you were barred from access to the sacraments, were you being barred potentially from entrance into heaven? Because the sacraments were a means of grace, right? So the Pope had a lot of power religiously to manipulate these kings, okay? Now over time, the kings are going to start to realize, most notably Henry VIII, is eventually going to say, forget you. You won't give me what I want. I could do this thing myself, right? So as time goes on and you get to the later Middle Ages and into the early Renaissance, a lot of these kings are starting to say, why are we ceding power to the See of Rome? And why not, when we could just have all this for ourselves? And so there's a lot of things, there's at least two or three things that are kind of like ingredients into where this idea is going to come from. But it is going to become a prominent idea. Elizabeth herself viewed herself as absolute, every bit as much as James does.
And then once it started way back, and then it was just a birthright. You were born into that.
You were born into that, and it was not questioned.
Yeah.
So this is, all of this is what I would consider pre-liberal. And when I say liberal, I mean liberal with a small L, not a capital L. I'm not talking about liberal on the modern political left. I'm talking about liberal in the sense of freedom of religion, freedom of speech, you know, limited government, all of those concepts. At the time, so when you have a king that's ruling absolutely, and now you have all these thinking of this political philosophy and ideology coming into existence about the people and you know, freedom of speech and freedom of religion and all of this stuff, that was the liberal movement of those days, right? To question all of this stuff. But as we'll see as we go through the rest of this, this whole thing about the king having absolute authority for a very long time just went totally unquestioned. People just were like, yeah, that, because you had that real strong connection with church and state still, that people didn't really question until the Reformation, for sure. And then after that, then the sort of floodgates are opened up on that.
So I know I'm kind of giving you a little bit of a rambling answer, but it's the best I can kind of do off the top of my head. But I don't think it's inaccurate. Anybody else? How much more do we have here? All right, we got to get moving. James's mother, Mary Queen of Scots, was executed in England on February 8, 1587. Following the death of his mother, James had another 16 years to occupy the Scottish throne. But those years proved him an effective king. A disassembling king, a player, a neurotic, canny, private, smutty, and somewhat paranoid king, but a capable king, a king who had long learned to keep and attend his own counsel, who might nod yes and think no, but a king nonetheless. Remembering, too, that his young mind, in spite of his forceful schooling, was like a sponge, and he learned from all of them, if no more from Elizabeth, her southern master. Like her, he learned to vacillate, to say one thing and mean or do another. Still, and for many reasons, he would never be an Elizabeth. Who cares? He was James. He, too, was one of a kind. So go to page 6. In the summer of 1588, saw the Armada crisis threaten England's autonomy. So this is the crisis with the Spanish Armada. While hindsight tends to view England's victory as inevitable, that was not the case by any means at the time. England and her queen were more vulnerable than people might realize. Instead of using the crisis as an opportunity to challenge Elizabeth's power, James remained loyal to the Queen. Quote, James, instead of taking advantage of her vulnerability, offered himself to Elizabeth as a son. He kept the Scots Catholics quiet and would not allow Scotland to be a port of entry for the Spanish or anyone else. So, is James supportive of Elizabeth during the Armada crisis? Okay. A decade later, in 1598, being a much more seasoned monarch, or I should say seasoned monarch, not monarchy, James set forth his views on divine right and politics with a pair of books, The True Laws of Free Monarchs, and I need help on the pronunciation on this one.
Basilicon
Dorna, or Dorn?
Doron.
Doron, right?
Yeah.
Basilicon Dorna, right?
Yeah,
Basilicon Doron. Basilicon Doron, alright. Sounds good enough, right? And by the way, however the teacher pronounces it, it has to be right. So, a fine first sample of kingly spine, this document, along with its successor, Basilicon Doron, 1589 or 1599, dates vary somewhat, okay? Expressed and amplified his beliefs in divine right and absolute, now that should say an absolute monarchy. To James, it was a matter of doctrine. It was an order established by God himself. So, the idea of divine right for James is an absolute tenet of faith. It's a doctrine. The Bible teaches it, according to James. Among other things, James believed that during a monarch's coronation ceremony, the individual is transformed or becomes, quote, possessed of those sacred powers of majesty that God alone can bestow or call into account. Thus, coronation was a type of baptism, an epiphany rolled into one. Okay? So what he's literally saying in these books is that when the king is coronated, something is happening spiritually, mystically, etc., at that moment, where they are possessed of those sacred powers of majesty that God alone could bestow. So, when he's coronated king, does he believe something, you know, uber spiritual happened to him when he was coronated as the king? While objectionable to modern minds, the notion of divine right did not originate with James. James is not like making this thing up out of the clear blue sky here, okay? Quote, there was nothing new about his belief. Indeed, for centuries, dynastic rulers had been led by these precepts, acting and judging as, quote, little gods on earth. Nor was this notion just some idle fancy of monarchs. some device to monitor and control life beneath them. It was, quote, the faith of the commoner as well. So the commoners, did they believe that about the king? Did they believe there is something special and unique and distinct about the king? Now that's real convenient if you're the king, right? Because you don't have to convince anybody about this. They already what? They already believe it, okay? In a culture that mingled religious faith and civil headship, it was unquestioned. There was as much spectacle about the throne of a king as there was at the altar of God. Now, I want to comment on that. This develops largely under Catholicism, but is there a lot of spectacle as part of the Mass? And is there a lot of reverence for that spectacle on the part of commoners? Well, do they think the same thing now about the king and his throne? So they were able to sort of tie all this stuff together at a time where people weren't really questioning all of this stuff, right? So the Jacobin Age, here's the point I mentioned earlier. The Jacobin Age was pre-liberal, meaning that the rights of an individual, personal freedom, and the right to question were not considered at that time. So nobody was running around saying, I have a Bill of Rights. You can't do this to me. This whole idea of divine right and James ruling in this way, this is pre-liberal in that sense, right? So you think about, you know, a lot of, I don't even hesitate to mention stuff, but there's a lot of stuff going on today, right now, with our current political situation, where people feel like they're being ruled from on high. And stuff is being decreed and they're just supposed to do it, right? And then what's the response? Well, you can't do that to me because you're violating my what? My rights. That are granted to me by this document and that document, et cetera, right? Well, no one had that idea back here. Okay? Is everybody following that? Now, there might have been people who didn't like everything the king did, which obviously is true, but there wasn't that same structure and mechanism to kind of protest against that like we have today in a post-liberal world, okay? And again, I'm not talking about the modern political left. I'm talking about liberal in the most generic sense of being, of having these, you know, these rights and access to protest and some of those kinds of things. So today, let's finish that paragraph. Today we demand a separate church and state. They did not. Okay, now, I know there's a lot made in our current situation about separation of church and state. I'll say this. I am very glad we do not have a state church in the United States. Okay? We don't have a state church, which grants each American the freedom to choose what they want to do, what they want to believe, where they want to go to church, etc., even what religion they want to be, right? While I think there are a lot of folks making bad choices about where to go to church and what religion they should be, a liberal system allows for them to be able to make that what?
Choice.
That choice. Okay? These people didn't have that system, and they never even thought to say the church and the state should be what? Separate. That's going to happen later on in history, right? One, look at the next sentence, one did not exist without the other. The claims of divine right were not a shock to the Jacobean. It was not the hard sell that we imagine. So we sit here in modern 21st century and we hear, oh, like, what is James doing? Well, you gotta understand, it was normal for James to think this, and was it normal for everybody in the society to agree that the king had this authority? Okay? So don't read our current understandings back on those folks, is what I'm trying to say. The true law of free monarchies is a simple and straightforward presentation of divine right and absolute monarchy. Keen states the following regarding this important book. Quote, it is basically a primer, a practical guide to teach his subjects their obligation to their sovereign and his obligation to them. Obedience to the king, that is, himself, was therefore a religious obligation, and any revolt was wickedness, a transgression against God. The true law, we should need to put that in italics, true law is brief, and it is written in very plain speech with few ambiguities. Quote, My purpose is to instruct, not to irritate, the king said. Kingship is scriptural, and all of the laws that determine kingship are written in the scripture. Even bad kings are sent among us as a king of judgment sent by God. The following excerpt served to highlight James's thought on the matter. James is utterly sincere. So this is a quote from James. Kings are called gods by the prophetical King David because they sit upon God, his throne in earth, and have the count of administration to give unto him. So James views himself as totally put there by God, and that James will one day give account to who for his administration as king?
Yeah.
To God Almighty. That's what he's saying in that quote. King, father, judge, lawmaker, minister of God, peacemaker, pastor, James leaves little room for any other interpretation of his office, nor will he suffer any. The king is, there's two Latin phrases here, he's first the Lord of all good, and he is direct Lord of the entire dominion. So I'm just reading the English there, okay? And again, it is an important innovation. Again, this is not an innovation, but a recapitulation, a clarification of an old what? So is James saying anything that hadn't been said before? But is he spelling it out clear for his, what's the word I want? For his countrymen, so to speak, the people that are under his authority, about how this relationship works. But there is more in it than that. His writing, much more than a display of erudition or craftsmanship, was a shepherd's staff. His whole intention is imperial. He sees himself, quote, as a loving, nourished father. A subject's service to the king is their service to God. Any resistance or opposition to the king is opposition to God himself. It is a very tight order. The king is appointed by God. He is responsible only to God, and the king is accountable to no law but God. This is the real key to understanding King James. This is heart central, the underpinning of all he believes. His belief is profound, incompatible with a world tending towards the individual, but if there is greatness to be discerned about him, it is on this wise. This is where he is most grounded. So James absolutely believes this. He buys this. This is what he's teaching the people in the books that he writes about what his obligations are to God and what their obligations are to who? Are to him. So the whole idea that a president or a governor has to be subject to some law other than God himself, that idea that a governor or a president or a king is limited in power by a governing document like a constitution or a bill of rights or something like that, that is not an idea that anybody had back here. That idea is beginning to its infancy amongst some high intellectuals, but it's not an idea that is widely accepted at that time. Okay? So, let me finish and then we'll take some questions. Prudence dictates that we also note the contribution of Mike Bascalon Dorn, the corpus of James's to the corpus of James's writings. Any search for James will bring you to Solomon, to Abraham, and to Jacob in him. That is the wise, the fatherly, the canny. In his book, Bascalon Dorn, Greek for kingly gift, he engages all of them. Divided into three books, the text is at once personal, then formal, but always instructive. It is difficult, at times, for modern tastes and stalls in places. The Solomon is lucid and generous. The Abraham is warm and nurturing. The Jacob is the one doing the writing itself. So he kind of plays different characters off of scriptural models. There is what you need to take from that. Still, James is not selling as much as he is stating his belief. He is more Israel than Jacob. The text is translucent, bright, with instruction and command. But James, as clear and as wise and as fatherly as he expresses himself, simply does not live by what he preaches, at least not completely. But being James, he believes that he believes what he is saying, and he is utterly sincere. It was meant to be a private publication, a gift from father to son. Prince Henry was 5. By the time James was King of England, just 4 years later, it was a runaway bestseller. So this book that I can't pronounce the name of, Bascalon Dorn, or it's got to be good enough, it's a bestseller by the time he becomes King of England. It was never intended for public consumption. It was intended to be a father addressing his princely son on the issues of rulership, but it becomes a bestseller in Scotland and England by the time he becomes king. Is it shameless self-promotion? So that's the question. Did he plan it this way all along? Is it a message to the Kirk, to those who tried to hold him down or beat the monarch out of him? Is it a clever piece of princely propaganda? He is king. He is James. Bascalon Dorn is an amplification on true law, in which James forwards the notion of divine right a bit further still. An opening sonnet acts as prologue to the body of the work and a glimpse of its spirit. So this is what James wrote. God gives not king the style of gods in vain. For on his throne his scepter do they sway. And as their subjects ought them to obey, so kings should fear and serve their God again. If then ye would enjoy a happy reign, observe the statutes of your heavenly king. And from this law make all your laws to spring, since his lieutenant here ye shall remain. Reward the just, be steadfast, true, and plain. Repress the proud, maintaining I the right. Walk always so and ever in his sight, who guards the godly, plaguing the profane. And so ye shall princely virtue shine, resembling your right, your mighty king, what?
Divine.
Okay, so what do we take from this about what James believes? Does he believe he rules by divine right? Absolutely. Okay. Consider the best prose James ever wrote. Bascalon Dorn is an instruction manual, a code of kingship. In a dream, James has a
presentiment
that his life would be cut short. So he kind of believes he's going to die early. He felt it necessary to write the book in response. I am not sure how harshly we should judge the king for his true law of free monarchs or Bascalon Dorn. He gives us something of himself. In particular, he lets us know just how deep his belief is. So, wrapping this up. Noting the comment, the contents of these chief works of James is critical to understanding his decision to authorize a new Bible translation of the Bible in 1604. When he makes that choice, he is making that choice out of what he believes religiously and spiritually to be the case and out of the historical and political context that he has inherited. He has reasons that go way beyond simply, yeah, we need to have another Bible. It is a political decision for him based upon the external situation that he's inherited now as being the king after the death of Elizabeth, as well as what he believes about kingship, what he believes about authority from his own personal time as the King of Scotland before he became King of what? England. So when he steps into that situation where he makes that decision, he's stepping into a specific historical context where there's a lot of things going on, but he steps into it with a philosophy, with a ideology, with a religious belief about his role in the matter to decide what should happen in England at that time. So the choice to retranslate the Bible is not a
flippant, unthoughtful choice the king makes. It is the result of both the context that he's in and what he believes about his role in that context. You guys following that? So, noting the contents of the chief works of King James is critical to understanding his decision to authorize a new translation of the Bible in 1604. For James, the decision was largely a political one, as we will see in future lessons. I'm almost done. Much more could be said about the personal life of King James that is beyond the scope of our purposes in this class. Our goal has been to focus in on those aspects of James's early life that most impacted his decision to authorize a new translation of the English Bible in 1604. Okay? Unfortunately, we're past time. I'm going to have to end the stream. If you guys that are here have any questions that you want to ask while we pack up, feel free to do that, but I've got to shut this down and move on for our main service, okay? So, thanks for your attention. We'll see you next Sunday. I will not be here. Blake is going to be your teacher next Sunday. Okay? So, all of you need to make